35. We will be hearing bills HB 50, HB 136, and HB 93 in that order. We will be on teleconference, and the first bill that, we do have a quorum. We have Representative Pat Carney, who is the vice chair of, co-chair of HESS, Representative John Gonzalez, Representative Betty Sherry Davis, and myself, Georgiana Lincoln. We also have Representative Betty Davis. And the first bill that we will be hearing is HB 50. It is my understanding that we have online January Scott from Chicago, Illinois, that is, I understand, going to be participating also. Representative Ulmer, would you like to begin?
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. I will make my remarks very brief, not only so that our phone bill to Chicago is kept low, but also because I'm supposed to be chairing a correction subcommittee meeting at the same time I'm here. So I'll just be real brief. There are other people who wish to speak, I know. House Bill 50 appropriates money to the Alaska Children's Trust Fund. The 1988 Alaska legislature created the trust fund to be a fund in which we could place money and have the income off of the investments of that fund be used to help prevent child abuse. At that time, there was a proposal that we use a permanent fund dividend checkoff to fund that fund. That became very controversial. All of a sudden, there were all kinds of other ideas about other good programs that might benefit from a permanent fund dividend checkoff. So as that bill proceeded, the dividend checkoff got dropped, but the Alaska Children's Trust Fund passed. It was passed without an appropriation, and the Alaska legislature has yet to see fit to put money into it. So basically, this bill is only an appropriation bill into this existing fund, which, as I indicated before, was passed in 1988. The amount which I selected is sort of working backwards. If you put $4 million into the fund, it's estimated that it will generate about $200,000 a year in interest income, which could be used for prevention programs. So any amount could be placed therein depending upon available revenues. $200,000 is about the amount that people feel could be wisely used in prevention programs based on community programs that already exist. Clearly, that number could go up if people felt that the money was there, because in my opinion, there is no money better spent than in prevention. We spend very little of our money in Alaska on preventing child abuse. And as you know, many other states in the nation have adopted similar programs, have put money into prevention, and have determined that it really does make a significant difference. So with that, Madam Chairman, I will leave here Diane Lindback, who on my staff has worked on this bill. She will be able to answer additional questions after you hear from the other people who wish to testify. And I really appreciate your willingness to hear this bill. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
And thank you very much. We have also been joined by Representative Mary Miller and Representative Mark Hanley. At this point, we'll hear from January Scott, who is an expert witness with the National Committee for Prevention of Child Abuse in Chicago, Illinois. Ms. Scott, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, and continue, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is January Scott. I'm Director of Training and Technical Assistance with the National Committee for Prevention of Child Abuse in Chicago, Illinois. And what I'd like to do is just spend a little bit of time explaining why I believe it's critical that a $4 million appropriation be made to the Alaska Children's Trust Fund. One, we know child abuse is at the core of many other social problems. So when we prevent child abuse, we're preventing many other social problems that fall after child abuse has occurred. We know that if child abuse is to be prevented, it must be assumed as a community responsibility. The Children's Trust Fund model shifts responsibility for child abuse prevention to the community. Over $28 million was raised by the Children's Trust Funds last year in fiscal year 1990. There are 49 states that have Children's Trust Fund legislation. The Children's Trust Fund model has four elements which exist in the Alaska model, which I believe are consistent in shifting this responsibility to the community level. First, there's a public-private partnership, mainly structured through the composition of the advisory board or the advisory commission. In approximately 15 states and another 8 states are looking at this type of activity, a comprehensive prevention plan has been adopted through the efforts of this advisory board or commission, which has been incredibly useful in trust funds providing direction for funding, but more importantly, it provides direction to communities about what needs to be done in their community to prevent child abuse. The second element that exists is that the trust funds fund primary and secondary prevention programs, which means they are programs for all the population or for high-risk populations. So even when a few states have mentioned treatment in the statute, the policy has been to fund only primary and secondary prevention efforts, which gives us an enormous pool of information about what's happening throughout the country with primary and secondary prevention. Programs funded by the nation's Children's Trust Fund serve as a laboratory in helping us understand what programs work for what populations. They're also being evaluated in many states, which provide other states the means of understanding, you know, the value of prevention. So this becomes a very critical piece in that all states fund primary and secondary prevention programs. The third element emphasizes community-based child abuse prevention efforts with a strong emphasis on volunteerism. So most of the trust fund dollars are going to community-based programming with an emphasis on volunteerism. In fiscal year 1990, 1,600 programs were funded nationally. The grant size ranged from a low of $1,700 in a North Dakota program to a high of $75,000 in a Florida program. The last element that I'd like to emphasize is that the Children's Trust Fund model institutionalizes prevention at a community level. Often structurally, this is accomplished through a matching formula. And as this model seeks to place parent support programs in churches, life skills education in schools and youth organizations, parenting education and support services in hospitals, prevention becomes institutionalized in our communities. They become institutionalized in existing community settings. The average grant size over the years has been between $20,000 and $25,000, and it's kept low on purpose because that allows the community to assume the funding. Two states have tracked the programming of the money after the trust fund has ceased funding the program for several years, and they have found that approximately 80%, one state found 83%, the second state found 79% of the programs previously funded were still in existence. The last point I'd like to make is that the trust fund model also leverages dollars from the Federal Challenge Grant Program, which was passed by Congress in 1984. This act called for a $1 match for every $4 spent by the trust fund. This match has also been very useful in leveraging private dollars for many of the state children's trust funds. So even though our child abuse prevention efforts are still relatively new and we don't have long-term studies that indicate how much money we are saving by investing in prevention, common sense tells us that there's an enormous savings in reaching parents before the problems become insurmountable. And even the early interventions in efforts such as Head Start indicate substantial savings when you reach families before the problem escalates to the point of damage for children and families. And with that, I'll stop, Madam Chairman.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? We appreciate very much you taking the time to be on teleconference to us today. I'm not sure what your time is back there, whether you're later or, but we do appreciate you taking the time to testify on behalf of HB 50. Thank you very much, and at this point we will drop you from the teleconference.
Thank you very much.
We do have five other people who have signed up to testify on the bill. First is Lynn Squires. Just sit right here, please. And if you could state your name for the record. And
are we still on top?
I was just going to check.
Matt Sue
is on a listen only. So And we do have others that are going to be coming online, so we will continue until conference. Just state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name's Lynn Squires. I'm a master's level therapist at Tongass Community Counseling Center in Juneau. At Tongass, I wear two hats. I'm a sex offender therapist at Lemon Creek Correctional Center. I'm also a family services treatment program therapist. It seems like really oppositional groups that I'm working with, but it's not oppositional when you consider that 11 of the 12 sex offenders that I work with are also victims of physical or sexual abuse as children. They say that one-third to two-thirds of sex offenders in the prison programs are childhood sexual assault victims. We're constantly working on prevention at Lemon Creek. What we want to do is make the program safe and prevent more victims from coming out. So how does that tie into what we're doing with children? The treatment is always the key. If we can catch these people, these sexual assault victims, as children, then a lot of times they don't go on to reoffend as adults. We're talking about keeping in crisis mode or preventing the problem before it occurs. Most often we know that the abuser becomes the abuser. Abused women that were abused as children, they go into abusive relationships or they become abusers themselves. Men do the same things. People tend to perpetuate that or reenact that trauma that they experienced as children. The victims begin to identify with the victimizer. That's a powerful position. That's a much more powerful position for the victim. What we do in prevention for my program, we get referrals for families in crisis. We get our referrals come directly from DFYS. These families are in severe crisis. They're in foster homes. The parents are alcoholic. The children have been sexually abused or physically abused. And so the social worker decides that they benefit from treatment. One family can take up so many different services. I have one family in mind. Two children, one 7-year-old boy, one 14-year-old girl, a mom and a dad that's out of the family. The dad is a sex offender. He didn't perpetrate against his own family, but he's taking up the services of a sex offender program and an individual therapist. The 14-year-old girl is involved with the school, Milam. She's involved with the alcohol program in school, the tutoring program in school. She's a member of a teen group. The young boy is involved with Big Brothers and individual therapy. The mom is involved with JRU, individual therapy, and family services. They're all into a family. We believe that family prevention is really important. If you identify the kids as the problem, then you reinforce that low self-esteem, which, again, begins to reenact when they become adults. That's why we really feel it's important to catch it before it begins. If you consider the fact that the average for one sex offender is that they have 76 victims. If 10 of those 76 victims go out and reoffend, then you never get out of this cycle. This cycle continues to perpetuate itself. That we have to get out of crisis mode. We need to get into preventative mode. Prevention's the answer. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Could you repeat that again on the, I just got the tail end on the number that you quoted there, 76?
The averages are, if I can remember correctly, the average sex offender, a man who molests children, not rapists, average man who molests has, I think it's something like 136 sexual contacts with children, but he has an average of 76 victims. We're not saying that every victim goes out and sexually abuses an adult, but if 10 of those 76, we've just got this triangle going up at an incredible rate. And we're always going to stay in crisis mode if we don't begin prevention now.
How many, if you're saying, how many do we have or do you know in the state of Alaska that are convicted sexual offenders of children?
Okay, at the Lemon Creek program here in Juneau, we have 12 men in program. 11 of those 12 men are victims of childhood sexual abuse or physical abuse.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Thank you for your testimony. We have Jenny Brotherton. Please excuse me if I slaughtered your name there.
That's fine.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record. Mark, could you check to see if the switch is on there, please? Okay, thank you.
My name is Jenny Brotherton, and I'm a master's level therapist for Tungus Community Counseling Center here in Juneau, Alaska. Do you want me to give my address like the 25th?
No.
Okay.
Not necessary. Thank you.
Okay. Basically, I do the same things that Lynn described, with the exception of I don't work for the sex offender program. I'm a child's counselor and family counselor, youth program counselor at Tungus Community Counseling Center. I work with children every day that have seen the effects of physical, sexual, and emotional abuse. I work closely with the Division of Family and Youth Services. We receive a lot of referrals and endings from them. What I'd like to speak about today, though, is the youth program that we do in the schools. The focus of that youth program is to see primarily boys that have anger problems. And as you know, anger problems often come out of families that that are dysfunctional in a way that the children are receiving or being part of a system that gives them physical or emotional abuse as well as sexual abuse. I receive requests from the school counselors on a daily basis to do more groups than Tungus is able to do. This is considered prevention money, even though the children that I see are already very much into the cycle that is happening in their families. Their father and mother have been abusive to them in ways that affect their self-esteem, that affect the core of who they are. And they come to school not able to function well enough to maintain sometimes in regular classrooms, as well as just being constant behavior problems in school. And so they look to us. Anger is one emotion of many emotions, and it's viewed in our culture as sometimes bad. Anger per se is not bad, the way we deal with anger. And these children are seeing that anger means pain, anger means belittling, anger means sadness, and a sadness they're not able to tell us about in ways as adults can. And I believe it's really important that we give them the chance to be able to experience all the emotions that they should be able to in life, and that anger is just an energy that means that we need to solve a problem, not be hit or be belittled. And so I think the prevention money that we're talking about is greatly needed, and I know that it would benefit for umpteen years to come, and it's very needed. I appreciate the time this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Representative Gonzalez.
Yes, Mr. Brotherton. First time I ever heard somebody, and I'm glad you did that, use that terminology about working with children with anger problems. Do you find that children with anger problems also lean towards sexual problems, abuse?
Well, anger is that something means that something is not being met, some need is not being met. And it can be. I mean, the way that they deal with it, if they have been sexually abused and they have anger, it can lead to sexual problems. It can lead to abusive behaviors as they get older. Sure, a lot of the men that we see at Lemon Creek that have offended, and we know have offended, have lots of anger. And as you know, rape is an act of violence, not a sexual act per se. It's an act of anger and violence.
Please continue, Representative Gonzalez.
If I may follow, but a child with an anger problem doesn't necessarily mean that it's been abused sexually.
No, it does not necessarily mean that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question about your youth program in the schools. How would that be dovetailed to the money coming from this fund?
Well, I wasn't speaking necessarily per se for the money to come into the youth programs in the school. I think that all of the agencies that are involved in this, ParentAid, AWARE, Big Brothers, Big Sisters, all of that deals with children that have whatever problems, anger being one of them. But to answer your question, I mean, the schools are requesting from us continued service on anger and just education to parents, to teachers, to school officials, and
to mainly children on what anger means and how we can use our anger to solve our problems versus turning it into more abuse.
Thank you. Can I continue?
Continue.
Well, what I'm concerned about is that it sounds to me as though you are catching these children at about as young ages we can catch them in school. Mm-hmm. And it sounds to me as though the income from this fund would be catching them at a later time. You know, in other words, when they become acting out in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the children are already acting out. I mean, I work at Gastineau, and they're acting out there. And so you're saying the money, it will be later on. Just prevention in general. I mean, wherever we can target it. I work with older children. I work with 16, 17, 8-year-olds. I have a group at the Miller House. I have a group at Lemon Creek Jail. And we're teaching the men in that program skills so that when they get out, they don't reoffend in what they've been doing. We can break the patterns, even as adults. It's a little harder, but we can do that.
Madam Chair, that was my point. I'm concerned that the money be brought to focus at a younger age, and I'm curious about how that can happen.
Well, we're doing that a little bit in terms of getting into elementary and middle schools. I've done home visits with Care and Aid, and we've gotten children in the home that have been about 4 or 5 years old, and of course our homemaker services go in when the children are very young.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions? At this point, we'll go to I have Pat Williams in Anchorage that wanted to testify on HB 50. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record and continue.
I'm Pat Williams, and I'm representing the Child Advocacy Network. The Child Advocacy Network is a combination of 170 individuals and agencies in the Anchorage area that work towards the prevention of child abuse and neglect. And I am here representing those 170 agencies and individuals to support House Bill 50 in establishing funding for the Child Trust Fund. We believe that those interest monies that would go towards primary prevention would be money well spent in alleviating the children who end up needing treatment later on. So we are in total support of prevention projects used in this fashion from a child trust fund.
Is that the extent of your testimony, Ms. Williams? Anchorage, are you still on?
I'm done.
Thank you very much. I don't know if there's... are there any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in Anchorage that wishes to testify?
No one else in Anchorage.
Thank you. We will come back to Juneau, to Virginia, John Daniels.
Madam Chairman?
Yes?
This is Matt Sue. I apologize for the interruption. We were in the midst of a conversation outside the teleconference hookup here. I'm not sure if you had called for testimony from Matt Sue yet or not.
You will be next. Excuse me, next after the individual here in Juneau.
Thank you.
Please continue, Ms. Daniels. State your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Virginia John Daniels, and I'm here representing myself as a client. I have been involved with the DFYS program starting maybe about 4.5 years ago when they came into my home and took my daughter away due to neglect and my alcoholism. I then was mandated to join the Parent Aid program, which I became involved with the Native Moms group there. And from there, I started learning communication skills with my daughter and disciplining techniques that I had never heard of or was just really foreign to me. And it was just like another world due to the way I was raised myself. in an alcoholic home where there was physical and mental abuse and a lot of neglect due to their alcoholism too. So it was just like another world to walk into the Parent Aid program and start learning these techniques. I have been a single parent. I have a daughter who is 10. I've been a single parent until recently. I just recently married. But since I've been involved with the Parent Aid program, my communication skills have grown with my daughter to a tremendous amount. I can't say today that everything is A-okay or a bed of roses. At this time, my daughter and I are dealing with the sexual abuse of her as of about 4 years ago, and she is receiving counseling through the Aware Shelter. It took my daughter this long to be able to tell me about it, and I think when she did finally tell me about it, it was because of my involvement with Aware and the Parent Aid program and being able to develop communication skills and know that it was okay to talk about these kind of things, because in the background that I was raised in, it was something that wasn't talked about, or it was just, there was just too much shame there or anything to deal with it. I have learned to deal with it with the help from the children's program at the Aware Shelter, and my daughter is working through going to groups at the Aware Shelter, and she is getting personal counseling at the Aware Shelter. And I don't believe it stops here. I believe that there's going to be a lot more, and as my daughter starts growing and getting into her teen years and stuff, there's going to be a lot of anger management to deal with, and just being able to be herself and be okay with herself. And these are the things that we are dealing with today, and I really appreciate the programs that I was able to stop the cycle of violence and neglect and alcoholism right here and be able to work with my daughter as a single parent. And hopefully our generations that go on will be able to live, you know, in a more harmonious way than we've had to deal with in the past. And I'd like to see the programs be able to build and offer more for our children.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We will go to Matsu, to Emo Portschiller. If you're on, please state your name and who you represent for the record and continue.
Yes, Madam Chairman. This is Emil Portschiller. I'm with National Center for Families and Children. I have just one brief question first. Are we still dealing with HB 50, or have we shifted our focus to other legislation?
No, we still are on HB 50.
All right, thank you. Are you able to hear me clearly down there?
Very clearly.
Just a few brief comments on HB 50, and our comments relate somewhat to those offered by January Scott earlier, and we would support in total her observations and recommendations, and would like to follow up just with the idea that we feel very strongly that Alaska is perhaps leading the nation in many areas dealing with child abuse, family and children's related problems, and that with HB 50 we have the opportunity of setting somewhat of a new direction and some goals for solving some of these problem areas. We would like very much for the funding appropriation to go forward in this bill, and would support it in total. That's basically all the comment we have for today.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Representative Gonzalez.
I didn't get the name of the person.
It is. I just set it aside. You know, Emil Portschiller. Portschiller. Thank you very much. I hope I don't slaughter this name. Sarah Lynn Tabachnik. I was very close. Again, please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Sarah Lynn Tabachnik. I work at the Aware Shelter in Juneau. I coordinate the children's program and do counseling with children who have been abused. A 1981 study funded by the National Center on Child Abuse and Neglect found that half of children who came to shelters were themselves physically or sexually abused. In the state of Alaska, 19,000 women were abused by their partners in 1986. 63% of those women had children who were abused. Further, when children witness abuse in their family, they are learning from their parents that violence is an acceptable way to solve problems. sons who witness their father's violence have a 1,000% greater chance of becoming abusers than those who do not. So the importance of providing safe shelter for battered women and their children seems clear. Not only does it prevent women from being abused, it also protects children from violence. And while women and children are in shelter, we facilitate personal safety and education groups to empower them with the skills and support to help them keep themselves safe. By providing appropriate intervention, we can prevent the generational cycle of abuse. Humans are born defenseless. We are totally dependent upon others to meet our needs, to protect us, keep us safe, care for us, love and nurture us. In fact, this is the job of a parent. Yet when we do not have our basic needs met, when children are humiliated, neglected, threatened, physically and sexually abused by the person who was to have protected and cared for them, the betrayal of trust the child feels leaves a long and deep scar. Child abuse can be, and is, physically and emotionally life-threatening. We need to protect children's lives and spirits. We need to work to prevent violence and prevent child abuse. To do this, we must have the support of individuals and systems. We must provide prevention information to children so that they can protect themselves. We need to teach them that they can say no to inappropriate touch, that they can learn the importance of telling an adult and know that they are not to blame. They didn't do anything wrong. They're not bad because an adult abused them. Last week, the education specialist at AWARE provided 3 45-minute presentations to middle school students. After her presentations, 12 students came to speak to her individually about personal safety concerns. We need to provide information for parents as well so that they can offer the loving care a child needs to develop his potential. We must offer parent support groups and intervention when they are abusing their children or fear they may do so. By providing information to children and parents, we prevent abuse. By providing safe shelter for battered women and children, we prevent abuse. There are no children testifying here today. They don't have the ways or means or words to speak to you. I am here on behalf of children to advocate for children's basic needs, for their safety and well-being, for their care and protection. Children deserve these things. It's not their fault that they don't have them. It's our responsibility to provide them. We all need to do what we can to advocate for those whose voices are not heard.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
You're welcome.
We next have Sherry Gohl. And I need not say state your name. And
for the record, my name is Sherry Gohl, and I'm representing both the Alaska Women's Lobby and KPAC today. Both organizations very strongly support this appropriation bill. I'd like to, you've heard plenty this morning about prevention and the need for it, and I'd just like to give you a little perspective historically on how we came to be asking for an appropriation for a fund that has been fundless for 3 years. The bill that created and established the Children's Trust Fund was introduced in early 1987 after a budget period where in 86 we faced our first very severe budget shrinking. And one of the first places for the budget to shrink was in the prevention line in the HESS budget. And it became apparent that we needed to look for some other place outside of political pressures to fund prevention programs. And the concept of children's trust funds was not new. I think perhaps the first person who testified gave you some kind of a overview of how many other states have dealt with this kind of thing. In other states, where they don't have our specific restrictions about dedicated funds, money for prevention programs have come from increased fees on licenses, birth certificates, different kinds of things in different states. And that's how then the money would be dedicated to the trust fund, and then interest from the trust fund would be used for these programs. In our state, we have a prohibition against dedicated funds. So the sponsor of the legislation at that time, because there was not very much money in general funds to be added when we were trying to at least restore some of the important prevention monies in the HESS budget, thought that an appropriate thing to do in our state might be to make a checkoff on the permanent fund dividend so that individual citizens could contribute $5 or $10 from their own permanent fund check to prevention programs. And that is the way the bill passed the House, with a funding source, basically. Even though it was not state funds, it was going to be a funding source. But the Senate decided that they did not choose to have a checkoff on the permanent fund, but then they did pass the bill. So the trust fund was created, but it had absolutely no money in it, so it is sort of a shell of something that can be. So we're back to the beginning, where we're going to need an appropriation from the legislature to start this off. The way the legislation is written, it is only interest from the money that can be spent on prevention programs, and that's why it's important that we have a large enough initial appropriation so that within some period of time we'll have enough money to fund any programs. And I, through the chair, I would like to address Representative Carney's question about early intervention and schools. The trust fund is set up to fund community-based programs, so it's a grant fund. Communities can design their own most appropriate programs, and it's certainly possible in primary prevention to deal with children who will be at risk basically even before they're born. We can work with teenage mothers whom we know are a category of folks who have a risk of abuse and neglect. These programs are not specifically sexual abuse, although you've heard very moving testimony on that. But there are other areas, physical abuse and neglect, where we also have to intervene at an early time and help people to change and break cycles and things that they have perhaps learned in their past. So I feel that the trust fund can really do a lot by funding community-based programs that are designed and by the communities themselves, something that's really appropriate, and then there is a board that will decide which of the competing grants get funded. In this particular budget cycle we are in, we are facing, again, drastic cuts to prevention monies and to early intervention monies. $1.6 million reduction in prevention, $685,000 in early intervention. It just points ever more clearly. And the reason why those cuts were able to be taken is because prevention is not statutorily required. And that's why the department will say, well, we had to meet these statutory requirements and we had to reduce our budget, so we had to first knock off the things that are not statutorily required. So it seems even more important at this point when it's clear that prevention is not a major priority within state government, that we find some way to fund and continue to fund prevention programs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Last, we have Kathleen Ray.
I'm Kathleen Ray, and I represent the Parent Aid Family Support Center. And I'd also like to represent all the children and families in the state who have been affected by abuse and violence. I have been involved with family life and children for 25 years as a professional and personally. And I've been 15 years of that, I've been in Alaska. And I am passionate about the work I do and believe in the importance of prevention. And I'm going to be real strong about my beliefs, so bear with me. But I really believe that early childhood experiences and family life impact us all through life. And we think of abuse as being physical abuse, the bruises, the cuts, the burns, the beatings. But when those signs go away, the effects last throughout our lifetime. And anyone who has had to go through counseling and treatment knows that we start by going back through our childhood and working through the pain and anguish and grief that we've suffered as children. So I believe that the most cost-effective way to impact the dysfunctions and problems in our society is through at the parenting level and at the family level. I think it's really critical. I would like to talk a little bit about how cost-effective parent aid is. We have been in existence since 1981 here in Juneau, and I think we're cost-effective because I believe we prevent problems that happen later in life. We work with criminals in the prison. We work with families who have problems with alcoholism, drug abuse, as well as child abuse and neglect, family violence, and other dysfunctions. And I feel by working at the parent-child level, by helping the parents learn alternatives to abuse and neglect, that we can impact the development of that child later in life. And I think that's much more cost-effective than many of the treatment programs that we have to pay for. Although those are necessary and absolutely needed and effective, I think we need to really look at how prevention really makes an impact. Parent Aid is a bare-bones program. We have several funding sources, but they're all relatively small. And we are funded primarily by state and city grants. we are faced with 67% cut this year, which will devastate our program. Most of our funding sources are, like I said, are small, and they don't want to pay for administrative and overhead costs. So we don't have any fluff to cut back on. We are dedicated to providing direct services to families. I believe that we are a user-friendly program, as Bill Hudson put it. He said that when he came to our program. Parents come to us and want to come to us. They like Parent Aid. They're comfortable. We are sensitive to their needs and to their characteristics and to their experiences. And I think we are a grassroots program. We serve them directly. We don't have a lot of bureaucracy. We're in a little house down the street, and the plumbing's always going out. And, we struggle in financially, but I think we are real excited about the services we provide and the people that we see and the success that we have. We see a lot of high-risk families. We see families with a lot of problems. Our staff is paid, our counselors are paid between $13 and $15 an hour, and they range. We've had some master's degrees levels and high school degrees on up. So we have minimal money involved for, I think, a lot of services. I could go on forever talking about the importance of prevention, and I just urge you to support this bill and support prevention in families and children throughout the state.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I'd like to call on Diane Lynn back, please, who will be representing Representative Allman. of all, is I believe that the governor has deleted the funding for the Commission on Children and Youth. Is that correct?
Well, I'm probably not the best person to answer that question. That is my understanding,
well,
but perhaps you could
ask if that is true, and I believe that the Children's Trust Fund Board is made up of the same people as the Commission on Children and Youth, and I was wondering how that would impact this bill. And secondly, that when we talk about the trust fund being a community-based child abuse prevention program, that I'm trying to think of how in community-based, does there have to be an already established program in the communities to do this? I'm thinking of the villages where there are not the programs that are there in the community, and just what we heard today is prevention early. Mm-hmm. I think that this is a wonderful avenue if we can tap all parts of Alaska with this.
Yes, my understanding, in answer to that question, my understanding is that it is not necessary to be a program in existence, that in any given year, any community in Alaska could form an organization, whether it is sponsored by the municipality or a nonprofit or whatever it may be, and could apply for a grant. So it is, I think the importance of it here is that communities have the opportunity to form those organizations and to target those programs and to allow those things to change over time. So it would be the most responsive to community needs as we can make it. And as to the question about the Children's Trust Fund Board, my understanding was that there was still money left in the budget for the commission members to meet. I don't believe there's any staff money still available in the governor's budget, but Pelleton Paul is here and she could answer that question later.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name, Diane. Thank you, Diane. I had a couple questions following up on January Scott's comments in this Alaska model where you have the public-private participation. Since this Children's Trust Fund was established, has there ever been any offering or attempt to enlist the help of any private individuals, corporations, or other entities in the private sector to contribute to that Children's Trust Fund?
Well, I can only speak for Representative Ulmer. She has just mailed out to all the registered voters in this district a brochure which instructs them on how they can make a bequest or a donation to the Children's Trust Fund. And so I think those efforts have to be made, and we're just beginning at that.
If I could continue, please.
Please continue.
That's encouraging to me. And with this leverage program where $1 of federal money is matched to every $4 on the state level, would that include monies coming from private individuals or groups? Would that be included as part of that $4 on the state level? Would you have any idea? Or would that match be for public funds, the $4 of state public funds?
If I understand your question correctly, I don't think it matters where the matching funds come from.
Okay. I think I have another question.
Please continue.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. To Diane, I did hear from Sherry Gall that, I think it was Sherry's testimony, that we're looking at cuts to prevention programs of $685,000. And this fund, at current market rates, the $4 million appropriation would yield approximately $200,000 in income. Would that be, is that expected the first year? And I'm wondering, certainly any amount is going to be a help, but I'm wondering why $4 million was requested and not more, or what was the decision to ask for $4 million, realizing perhaps that we had this much larger cut above this $200,000 that would be realized out of the interest?
That's an excellent question, and I think the answer is a political answer. Just a matter of Representative Ulmer's political judgment as to what would be feasible. The need is so great, and we're seeing that the responsibility that Alaska as a community is taking is dwindling. I mean, we're going in the wrong direction if we're going to impact this problem in the long term. So this is a start, and I'm sure Representative Ulmer would welcome amending the bill to make that sum larger.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Representative Hanley?
Yes, I have somebody. I was just looking at the statute on the trust fund itself and looking at some of the programs. I have some concerns, not so much with the amount of money that's going, but where it's going, because so many times we see it caught up in administrative costs. And in the grants themselves, they have a line that says no more than 10% may be used for administration. Yet that doesn't apply to the amount out of the fund. And in fact, it says up to $150,000 a year from the principal may be used for administrative costs of the commission, as well as $50,000 until 1992 to be used for obtaining grants. And I have a concern with that particular portion in that I'd rather see, I mean, that could continually draw down the balance of the principal that we're, you know, put in there. So I guess I have some concerns more with the current statute and the way it was set up, and that there's no limit on the or there's a $150,000 limit on the amount of administrative funds coming out of the principal, mm-hmm. which concerns me. And it doesn't necessarily say there's a limit on the amount of administrative funds that could be taken out of the grants before they're even, or the net income even before they're awarded. So.
Through the chair, I share the concern. I understand what you're saying. I was not, I did not work for Representative Ulmer when that statute became effective, and I'm sure there are others who can answer it better than I could. I do feel certain that that was undoubtedly formed with the idea that a great deal more money would be. But as you can see when you listen to someone from Parent Aid or from Thomas Council and realize that their staff are working far below market rates for their mm-hmm. skills, that the whole emphasis here is getting it out to direct services to people in the communities.
Representative Hanley, there's a portion on page one from the Commission on Children and Youth that states that third paragraph that the Children's Trust Fund is third paragraph, I guess the last sentence, the statute requires that the principal remain in the fund in perpetuity and that only the net income from the investments be used as a funding source.
I read that as well, and then I looked at the statute, and if you look at right in the statute, it says up to $150,000 a year may be appropriated from the principal of the fund for administrative expenses of the commission. And my concern, again, is that, and this isn't trying to be critical of the commission or anything, but particularly when their budget is cut back, and obviously they're going to be looking for funds that we may be forcing them to take $150,000, and maybe that's the desire of the committee is to set up this fund and to do that, but I think it should be brought out. And like mm-hmm. I said, I think the true desire is to get the money to the direct right. service providers. And like I said, there's a 10% limit on their administrative expenses that may be used, and the same doesn't necessarily apply to the money in the grants. And I was just concerned about that particular portion.
We do have somebody in the audience that maybe could answer the question of Carla.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Carla Timpone, and I either am or am not the executive director of the Alaska Commission on Children and Youth, depending on which radio station we listen to. In response to Representative Hanley's comments, I believe it was the intent of the bill's sponsor back when this legislation passed in 1988 and then when the Children's Commission bill passed last year to have the funding in the trust fund also serve as a way to allow the commission to be self-sustaining, as opposed to the commission each year having to request funding from the legislature for purposes of its operation. And that is why there is a cap language in there, too, why only up to $150,000 of the principal, not the net income, can be used for the operation of the commission. As you're aware, grants can only be awarded from the net income of the fund, and as Sherry pointed out, that's the reason why it's necessary to have a rather large appropriation up front, because we are talking about a process that's going to take some time here. It will have to be invested, and then only the income from that investment can be awarded to community-based programs or projects, to answer your question, too. They do not have to be private nonprofit organizations already established in a community. While I got the floor, if I may, Madam Chair, I also wanted to be sure that it was perfectly clear that this can only be used for funds from the trust fund may only be used for primary and secondary prevention programs. They cannot be used for treatment. They are not meant to supplement or supplant treatment funds. They are intended only for primary and secondary prevention. For instance, for the past 2 years, the state of Texas, with a $1.3 million appropriation, has devoted those funds in their entirety to parenting programs. Most states have found that the most successful programs they operate in terms of preventing child abuse and neglect are with first-time, high-risk parents. Most of those programs are home-based programs. A volunteer in the community visits that first-time parent once a week for the first year of the child's life. So we are talking about those kinds of community-based programs or broad-based parenting education programs with the sole purpose of preventing child abuse and neglect. If I might, too, in response to your question, Madam Chair, the Alaska Commission on Children and Youth is authorized by statute to serve as the board of the trust fund. However, when and if the Children's Commission ceases to exist, there is a mechanism already established in the bill which created the original trust fund 3 years ago that a board would be established through the Department of Revenue with the Commissioner of Revenue, I believe, serving as chair of that board. So even if the Children's Commission ceases to exist, there is still a mechanism in place to operate the trust fund and award those grants should this bill pass.
Going back again to so that I can fully understand this bit, then the interest that's derived from the principal mm-hmm. is what is used
for the grants.
Grants.
Yes.
The administration could have a cap of $150,000.
It does, in fact,
From the principal.
From the principal.
So what Representative Hanley was speaking of then, I could see where you could erode this fund. If you take $150,000 out, you no longer have $2 million to work from for the interest, for the grants. So the grants then could conceivably get smaller.
It does decrease the principal. And, of course, I can't speak for the sponsor of the bill, but I believe what his intention was, and Sherry may even be able to speak to this more accurately, is a way to sustain the commission as opposed to every sunset period or every funding cycle requiring the commission to request operating funds, and it could, in fact, take those funds out of this fund instead.
And the Children's Trust Fund Board then makes the determination as to how the principal would be invested?
No, the commissioner of the Department of Revenue has authority for that.
Thank you. Are there further questions?
Thank you
very much. That does conclude the testimony of those that have signed up to testify. I realize that we're running out of time again, ladies and gentlemen, and we have two other bills before us. What is the wish of the body for HB 50?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative
I have the same concern that Representative Hanley has raised, now that he's quoted the statute, but I'm very supportive of this bill, and I'd like to see it moved on to the next committee. Perhaps we might do that with some recommendations. I don't know what needs to be done, but since it's going to finance next, is it?
Yes.
That's correct.
They could probably take care of that.
I'm sure that they will be addressing that. Representative Hanley?
I do have those concerns, but this is an appropriation bill, and you can't actually change
change substantive law in the bill, so this isn't available to us to make those changes. I did want to bring them up. And one other point, just for the record, the net income of the fund, and these are changes that I would like to see actually to the way the program is run rather than to just worrying about the money right. that's being appropriated. But the net income is not solely used or is not restricted to being... There is potential there to hire additional people as fundraisers, and that may be appropriate, but it also may not be.
Your mic, Mark.
And
you don't need to repeat it.
Okay, but I have the concerns about the net income as well as the principal, and that maybe some of those fundraising mechanisms should be also included under the $150,000. And actually, I'd like to see the principal remain as the principal period, and not be touched, because it does erode and you get into the whole problem. So.
Representative Kearney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a good piece of legislation. I think it's going to be difficult to get the money to fund it. I see this as a basic mental health issue, about as basic as you can get, actually. And if it's possible for this committee to do so, I would like to recommend that we move the bill to finance with a recommendation that the money to fund this come from the mental health settlement, which is the appropriate place for it to come from. I think a place where we can get the funding if the mental health issue is settled.
Thank you, Representative Kearney. Representative Davis and I, Betty Davis and I, both came from a meeting last night where we discussed under the HESS Finance Subcommittee, who all falls under the Mental Health Trust, and it is going to be a hotly debated issue as to who falls under there. There's some very strong feelings about that, so I don't know that we can make that recommendation. We can certainly make the recommendation, but the Mental Health Trust Commission, the board is very solid on that.
I won't make that as a motion, Madam Chair.
What is the wish of the body?
Madam Chair, it would be my recommendation that we pass this to the next committee, Finance Committee, for their consideration without any changes.
Is that a motion?
Yes.
With individual recommendations?
I don't know if that's necessary, but if people feel they need to do that, I don't have any problem stating it that way. I'd like to see unanimous consent the way it is. If there's an objection to that, I would say with recommendations.
Then the motion is that we pass HB 50 out of HESS unanimously. Is there objection?
Yes.
There is objection.
So with recommendations.
Then, as the maker of the motion, then with individual mm-hmm. recommendations. If there is no objection, we will so order. So ordered. Well, we have 20 minutes to take care of two more bills. But this next one is going to be very easy. HB 136. We have Representative Sherry Davis. Representative Davis, would you like to take the floor?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is a pretty simple bill, surprisingly enough, coming from me and considering what we usually have to work with around here. Current Alaska statutes, for the record, my name is Representative Sherry Davis from Ketchikan. Current Alaska statutes allow grandparents to petition the court to allow visitation with their grandchildren in the event of a divorce. Grandparents often provide the support children need, especially when there is instability in the child's home. The intent of this bill is to keep foremost the best interests of the children and to ensure grandparents have the right to petition for visitation in the event there is no marriage and thus no divorce. Section 5 of the bill is simply language to clean up the divorce statutes and to eliminate unnecessary criteria for divorce, which are no longer used by the courts in any event. And I guess I'd just like to further add, Madam Chair, I know that when I was a very young parent and was divorced and had two small children of my own, I was not always a perfect parent.
My mother was always, however, a perfect grandparent, and my kids had some stability in their lives at a time when they desperately needed it. They always knew they could go to grandma. They always knew that they had that support base. And because of that, I think even though, you know, we went through some trials and tribulations as my children were younger, and I was growing up along with them, my children are very, very secure children and have made very much of success of their lives. My older children and my younger son is obviously on his way to that. And I give a lot of credit to that for my mother in particular, my parents. And so it seems to me that in this society that we're living in, where there are so many single family homes, so many broken marriages, so many relationships that go astray, the children, as we know from all of the testimony we've had on previous bills, are always the ones to suffer. But they shouldn't have to suffer not having the ability to have those grandparents be a stable part of their lives when and if it's possible to do that. And this is the intent of this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We do have somebody in Anchorage that is in a time constraint that would like to testify on HB 136. Richard Hermosillo?
Hermosillo.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Only reiterate.
I'm sorry, would you...
Last speaker.
Excuse me to interrupt you here, but would you please state your name and who you represent for the record, and then proceed.
My name is Richard Hermosillo. And I'm an interested party, a voter in this state, and I'd like to just express my support for this bill also. And I'll conclude with that. I'd like to move on to specifically 93. May I comment on that since I am under a time constraint?
How long will you be there?
Well, actually, I'm now late for a doctor's appointment, and that's my problem.
Yes, proceed.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to... I only found out about this Bill 93, the House Bill 93, and I'd like to point out that it scares me. It indicates to me that the custody investigator or representatives thereof, as stated in language of the bill, makes neutral mediator of these parties. And in a sense, what is a neutral mediator if not an arbitrator or of the like? And I'd like to caution the body in bringing this into law, because it not only gives, it does not give a clear understanding, definition to what a neutral mediator is. It leaves open for definition by that institution of the custody investigator's office. And in arbitrating, will it be a binding arbitration? Will the custody investigator make rules, make decisions that take away the power of the courts and the individual families involved? This is very bad and ill-advised condition of affairs. I think that the body should instead look at the bill that was introduced last year, Senate Bill number 519, which at least gave a guidelines for visitation and custody of minor children, and I understand that bill did not pass according to talks that I had with Senator Halford's office, because those people were not, that bill did not address it only addressed the typical Monday through Friday 9-to-5 individuals, and it left out many situations. Well, I think that with a little bit more effort in amending, making amendments or rewriting that particular bill, that it could be designed to give a clear understanding for standards on visitation, and that would go along with standards of visitation for grandparents also. As we have it now, there is no set legislation that outlines the rights of visitation. Only that the courts assign a reasonable visitation, which they often do, and this puts non-custodial parents in a very and children in a very disadvantaged situation in respect to where there might be problems, which there often are. Alaska, I understand, has a great number or a higher number of situations where you have divorce, and I feel that if we leave our decisions to our families, to the bureaucrats in a state or even a private individual, that that our rights and that our discretion will be taken away from us. And I think that if we only can outline a clear picture of what visitation is and what the rights of a parent and a child are in relation to visitation, then of course we wouldn't need this very, very ambiguous definition of what a custody investigator is to do by neutrally mediating. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We are now back to HB 136. One moment. Okay, we've got a couple other people that's online here. We have two people in Matsu that would like to testify. Emo Portschiller, are you there? And after you, I have Jim Clover. So if you could please be very brief in your testimony. I apologize, but we do have another bill to take up after this, and I would appreciate if you would be brief in your statements. Emo, would you please begin?
Yes, Madam Chairman. Again, for the record, my name is Emil Portschiller. I represent National Center for Families and Children here at Palmer. I think what I will end up doing is faxing down to you a copy of the recommendations for some amendments to the proposed legislation. But in general, I'll offer a few recommendations here. First, I would agree with the initial speaker addressing HB 136 that the basic intent of the bill to provide access by grandparents or contact with children in, let's just say, dysfunctional families, that it's a good idea in a very broad general sense. However, we think that HB 136 needs some substantial revision in order to adequately address that. We feel that there is one primary problem with HB 136, HB 93, Senate Bill 100, and so on. This seems to be a constant flavor of this family and child law or proposed legislation, and it is that the judiciary seems to be being placed in a position of making professional sector determination relating to family and child law, and we think that there's a key distinction that needs to be made here. The judiciary is by no means in position to be making professional sector determinations. We feel strongly that the judiciary, as it is involved in these issues, is best placed in position to implement statute, not to be making these professional sector determinations. And we see see this very problem existing in HB 136, that the current wording in HB 136 strongly concentrates the judiciary's power, if you will, in making determination. Once again, I'd like to reemphasize that we feel strongly determination of the best interest of a child, as an example, is not a function of the court. It is a function of the private sector or related service organization. The court should be in position of implementing those private sector determinations. I'd like to skip through most of our conversation due to the time constraint here and just address the very briefly the four components of the proposed legislation, HB 136, that we feel need specific revision. Line 5 indicates that the court shall award custody on the basis of the best interest of the child. In determining the best interest of the child, the court shall consider all relevant factors, including those factors enumerated in AS 25-24-150C. We would recommend deletion of that language and insertion with this. The court, in initiating custody award, shall consider all relevant factors, including those factors enumerated in AS 25-24-150C. Custody award shall be made based on implementation of private sector determination of custody, that is, in the specific interests of the child, which shall include the specific input of the child or children whenever possible. The second area is that we feel needs amendment or revision are lines 7 through 9. In a custody determination under this section, the court shall provide for visitation by a grandparent or other person if that is the best interest in the best interest of the child. We would recommend to you or offer this comment that the basic thrust in the proposed legislation, HB 136, of providing for avenue for contact by grandparents, it's a very good one, a very positive move. However, there are two problems that exist in the wording and the general approach to this subject area. The first problem area is quite similar to that that we recommended in, or noted in our earlier comments. The amendment to the proposed existing legislation leaves the judiciary once again in the driver's seat as to determination. Must restate here that the judiciary should function to implement statute and not make determination. The second problem area with lines 7 through 9, as it is proposed, the existing statute is that, as written, it fails to give any, say nothing, of adequate recognition to the fact that grandparents are, based on statistical information, frequently the perpetrators of marriage and family dysfunction and dissolution and child-family separation. One of these cases serving as best example of this is that of Carolyn Smith versus Smith in Houston, Texas. It has actually become a landmark in this particular area of family and child law. We feel, therefore, in addressing whether there is an indication of a need for grandparents to play a role in contact with the children, we feel strongly that such determination should not be left to the judiciary, but rather to the private sector, professional community, and clergy. Our specific proposed amendment is the deletion of the wording, in a custody determination under this section, court shall provide for visitation by a grandparent or other person if that is in the best interest of the child. We would recommend insertion of, in a custody determination under this section, the court shall provide for visitation by a grandparent or other person if that is determined to be in the best interest of the child, to include the direct input of the children whenever possible.
Emil?
Yes.
Yes. Are you just about through with your summary? Because we do have other people who want to testify, and we're scheduled until 10 o'clock. You are able to submit all of your comments, the written comments, via the LIO there, and to submit it for our record and for our consideration as well.
Yes, Madam Chairman, I'll try to conclude in about a minute and a half if that's still available to me.
I would rather you cut that even shorter. We do have other people who want to testify as well.
All right, I'll try to cut that in half. Third recommendation for changes would be in the areas of line 11 through a 12. We would recommend the insertion of this. A divorce may be granted for an incompatibility of temperament that has caused irremediable breakdown of the marriage, except where mental incapacity has been documented to be affecting the marriage partner seeking the divorce. In lines 16 through 19, we would recommend insertion of the following. Support and visitation are just as between the spouses and in the best interest of the children of the marriage, as achieved through private sector determination and report. The court may direct the visitation by grandparents and or others shall be considered in the achievement of determination as to whether the parents' agreement on visitation is in the best interest of the children under this paragraph. And with that, I'll conclude, Madam Chairman, and I'll be glad to forward a copy of our more detailed recommendations to you today.
Thank you very much. We next have Mr. Culver, and again, I would dearly appreciate it if you would be brief.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Jim Culver, a member of Alaska Dads and Moms. Thanks for this opportunity to testify on House Bill 136. First of all, I'd like to thank the sponsor, Sherry Davis, for this piece of legislation. It's something that's in society's best interest to continue the relationship of a child, children, and their grandparents or other relatives or possibly step-parents. And I think this bill also addresses the step-parent issue because it gives the court the authority to have visitation orders provided for step-parents. We support this bill and we'd like to see this thing move out of committee. It's a good statement we're making here. There's a few things changing here that in the dissolution and divorce statutes that we don't see any big problems with. But we think as a policy statement, as a social agenda, that this is long overdue, and we'll clear up some of the conflicts and heartaches that when we do have, for instance, a problem where we have a child that's foster ward of the state, and we have grandparents that would like to be a part of that child's life, but yet the parents are incapable of carrying on that relationship, that we can now look towards this statute to provide some family for those children and have less of a link to the state where the children will be more functional and be able to be more of a part of society. So this is a good one. I'd like to see this one go. That's all I have. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Culver. We next have Sherry Gall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will be very brief. The Alaska Women's Lobby supports this legislation. We think that the changes proposed by the sponsor to visitation by grandparents are very good. Section 2 that repeals a fairly archaic statute and replaces it with something very simple is also a very positive step. I would say that after the testimony that we've heard today, it is clear that there are people who would like to revise the entire family law system that we have. And if you don't want to make this bill the vehicle for it, you might consider looking at the title and making it more close to the substance of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes all of those who wish to testify on HB 136. Is there further discussion from the
yes.
committee? Representative Hannon.
I agree totally with the intent to allow grandparents contact. My concern is in the first section, it says in custody determination, the court shall provide for visitation by a grandparent. Above, it's upon petition of a parent that they're... the court awards custody, and in the statement, the sponsor statement, it mentions that the intent is the bill to ensure parents have the right to petition for visitation. It's not clear to me that maybe this has said that in the first case that the parents have to petition for custody, and then that because they petitioned, obviously they'll be determined what the visitation will be, or whether it's joint custody or single custody, but it's not clear that the grandparent, it just says the court shall provide for, in this case, that they don't have to petition. I'm wondering if that was the intent or if I'm misreading it.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know what the intent was, and you've got a good question, and I will research that further because, in fact, that will be one of the questions I'm sure that will be asked in judiciary in any event. I think that the statute that refers to this clears that up, but I'm not positive, and so I will definitely take that into consideration.
Are there further questions? Representative Carney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the sponsor of the legislation, it does provide for the parent to petition, but what is the situation if the parents are deceased?
Representative Davis?
Well, my intent is to allow a grandparent to petition the court for visitation as well, so that if the parent were deceased, the grandparent could then, regardless of the child's situation, as in one of the previous testimonies pointed out, it could be a child that's in foster care, it could be a child that's in another kind of situation, but my whole intent and my sole intent is to allow grandparents to have an opportunity to petition for visitation rights with that child wherever the child is residing.
Okay.